Presentation for Monday, February 9th, 2015. Welcome. I'd like to, first of all, for the committee, in your packet of information, which is, I think today's the last day for paper, is an article that Representative Reardon brought. It was out of the Oregonian and thought you might be interested in it last week, so you have a copy of that.
Must be excellent.
It must be excellent because Representative Reardon brought it. Yes, it is. Okay, today we're going to start out with an informational hearing on testing and assessment. And take good notes because you will have a test on it at the end of the program.
Would that be the smarter balance test?
They think I'm not serious.
Remember, she was a teacher.
Yes. So anyway, no, the most fun words for a high school teacher is get out your pencils, pop quiz. We like doing that. So we're going to start out with the informational hearing, but I also like to welcome a lot of retired teachers here today from the OEA Retired Group. So welcome. Okay, today for the informational hearing, we have Dr. Nancy Golden. We also have Rob Saxton, and I don't know how you are going to do your thing, but we will introduce you. So we're going to open the informational hearing on testing and assessment.
Sure. Cher Doherty and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden. I'm the Chief Education Officer for the state of Oregon. And I'm going to share with you some work that this is really the first official place we've been sharing that. And that's about a group I've been working with who we refer to ourselves as the group looking at developing a highly effective effective assessment system. One of the roles I like best about OEIB is getting to get feedback from the field about what's working and what's not working and try to bring forward policy that can improve on that. So there's been a lot of conversations about over-testing. We've heard that, and the governor also heard that. So he asked us to bring together a group of people who could come together and really look at this. So the people in this group, there were teachers from across the state. We work side by side with OEA, the governor's office, the Oregon Department of Education, and a national expert that some of you might know called Rick Stiggins. And we've been meeting for about over a year to think of what some ways we can really improve our assessment system to move from a primary focus on a summative assessment that does inform us about systems, but more to assessment, which we call formative, that can inform the teacher every single day in their classroom so they know how to really monitor and adjust for their students. My experience as an educator for 41 years is that the pendulum swings back and forth, and we've really been in a place where there's been a real focus on assessment, and that's really good. This group believes we're all accountable. But on the other hand, we've focused just on one side of the pendulum. So what this group did is that it really looked at current assessment practices. It looked at what other states are doing around assessment, and it really co-created a shared vision of how can we really create an effective system for all of our students and for our educators. What you'll see in the system, again, is what we refer to as a balanced system, one that looks at there's three really important parts of assessment. One is the formative everyday interim, which is more like unit test, and then that summative at the end. We're just very excited about the idea that we could use assessment to inform instruction. And I think the other key things about assessment, we know there's like a three-legged stool. It's the curriculum, what we teach, the instruction, how we teach it, and then the assessment of how do we look at how our students are doing so that we can monitor and adjust. So that's what we've been working on. I want to let you know that when you look at these recommendations, because you have them, these are draft recommendations that we're going to take out to the field, and we're really identifying all of the stakeholders who need to weigh in on this. And so when you see these recommendations, don't feel like they're done. Just know that it's a set of recommendations that we think can make a real big difference. So the recommendations are in front of you. It's a document that looks like this.
I was just going to ask you when we're going to have the recommendations.
Yes.
So.
And what you should also know is that there is a 17-page document that are sort of the values and beliefs that came, that made us come up with these recommendations. So I'll get those to your committee administrator, and then they can get them out to you. And then there's a timeline. But again, we're just beginning the feedback from the field, from multiple stakeholders. So that's, I just wanted to leave that with you today. If you want more information, you know where to find me. We're willing to meet with every one of you, or I'm happy to come back and talk more specifically about the recommendations.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Golden? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Continuing on the informational hearing on testing assessment, we have Rob Saxon from ODE. Anybody else, or just you? And yourself.
Chair Dory, I think just me. Okay. Unless I get into really deep water. So, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. And I think my task today is to talk a little bit about Assessment 101, or at least that's what my presentation is titled. And so I'll do my best to do that and happy to answer questions anyway along the way. Before I do that, I do want to just really recognize the work that Nancy just handed you. Mm-hmm. That's been done and really convened by Nancy at the request of the governor and also OEA. And it is a really excellent piece of work, and I've had the opportunity to participate at every step along the way. It's a piece of work that I think really will put Oregon on the map about being more forward-thinking about how we think about and use assessment. And the collaboration that came together to put those 12 recommendations in front of you, and also the 17-page document that is really important to read to understand the recommendations, is a great piece of work. And I just want to recognize the part that OEIB played in that, because it was a really important component of bringing that together. So. Today, I'm going to talk really broadly about assessment results, a little bit about standards, some of the basics of Oregon's assessment, and then a little bit of specific, and I even have a couple assessment questions, not that I would expect anybody to actually work them, but just as examples of what it would look like is going to be on some of the assessments that we have this year. I think it's really important for us to understand. Nancy talked about the three legs of an assessment stool. Formative assessment, sort of regular feedback. Interim assessment, which is periodic feedback. And summative assessment, which is really feedback at the end of a given year, typically. And I use the same word three different times as I describe those. And each time I described it, I talked about feedback. And that really what assessment is a constant stream of feedback that we take in about instruction, what students are learning, and then the feedback that gives us an opportunity to think about how we work with that so that we can help students learn more. And that's a really important component of what assessment really is all about. And by way of example, I thought I would just start off with some of the kinds of information that people share with me on nearly a daily basis as the Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. And so this is some information that I work with all the time, and almost every day someone wants to share with me some piece of data about something that comes right out of the Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills. So this is one that I've been paying a lot of attention to. 68% of our students at third grade currently read at the benchmark in third grade, and we know how important that outcome is when it comes to students being able to be readers. And so it really tells me, as I look at that, 68%, it's a piece of feedback that says we've got some work to do. If this really is important about students graduating or not graduating, we need a much higher percentage of our students graduating or being able to read at benchmark at the end of third grade than what we currently have. And by the way, our four-year cohort graduation rate last year was 68%. And so when I look at our third grade reading outcome, and our graduation rate, and they're almost identical, our four-year cohort graduation rate, it tells me something about how important this is as a component. So there are a couple other pieces that this slide tells me, too, because it says that our Hispanic-Latino third grade benchmark is 48%, and our economically disadvantaged is 57%. And it tells me that we have both an equity and an economic gap when it comes to outcomes with kids. And it gives us lots of information about where we need to focus how we need to think about our resources and the programs that we implement so that we can close that achievement gap. And so those are just a couple pieces of data or feedback, if you want to get more specific, that I think are really important. And but for the fact that we have these assessments, I wouldn't know any of that, and neither would anyone else.
Madam Chair, questions now or at the end?
As we go.
Chair Doherty,
sure, go ahead.
If I could, how long has OAKS been around? How long has that been the testing?
Chair Doherty, Representative Peluso, I know it predates 2000. Okay. There have been several different names that the assessment system in the state of Oregon has been under, and the moniker of OAKS, Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills.
Maybe 91, I think
1999.
Oh, yeah. 99?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, we had it down as 91.
Yeah, so. 91.
How about the 90s?
Okay, the 90s works.
So there have been previous iterations of our assessment system that I think started in 91 or 92, and but we didn't call them the OAKS at that point in time. Right.
If I may, a number of districts had their own assessments as well.
Okay.
Portland had its own set of assessments called the PALT assessments that they ran for up until mid 2000s.
Thank you.
So there are some other things that we can tell as a result of assessment results or the feedback that we have. Besides just where are we today, we can also look and see what kind of progress are we making. I thought that this was an interesting piece of data. It is our fifth grade math results and our eighth grade math results, and it shows that in 2008, 44% of our students were meeting the benchmark, and in 2014, it was 16%. And so there's something happening there, and math is not an easy thing to move, but you see a 16% increase in the numbers of students or percentage of students who are meeting the benchmark. And you can see in eighth grade math, it goes from 51 to 63. So it tells us if we're headed in the right direction or if we're flat or if we're headed in a wrong direction with some of the work that we have underway. It also gives us an opportunity to make some comparisons. You'll see here two very specific pieces of information that tell us that when we look at third grade reading on Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills, and this is from 13 to 14, these are actual districts. I just call them A and B because it seemed nicer. And the thing that I know about these two districts is that their demographics are as similar as any that you could find. And so the students look and show up in very similar ways. And in District A, 76% of the students meet the benchmark, and in District B, 15% of the students meet the benchmark. And if I'm in District B, I'm wanting to know what District A is doing. And there's also a possibility that we ought to look at District B and figure out how we support them and give them what they need so that they have an opportunity to do better with the students that they're currently serving. This is a little different look at that same thing, but these are the same two districts. Again, District A and B. It's a little bit small up there, but what you'll see is that over time, from 2007 to 2007-8 to 13-14, what's happened in these two districts. So in District B, you'll see that there are 6% more students now meeting in math on the fifth grade benchmark than were previously in the 2007-2008. And in eighth grade math, it's an increase of 1. And in third grade reading, it's a decrease of 2%. And if I go to District A, I see something really different than that. Growth of 25%, 16%, and 14%, and that's percentage points, not percent. And so 25% more students, percentage points of students, are actually achieving in third grade reading than they were, and that district is making really significant gain. And so I want to know what that district is doing and begin to replicate that in some other places. And without the assessments that we give, we would not have this information. So that's sort of a broad overview of why I think that having some of this information is a value. We can get to really looking at, on a statewide level, what the data says, on district-wide level what it says, and school by school what the data says as we think about what we want to do. We also use assessment for one other thing, and that is for the demonstration of what we call essential skills. So to earn a diploma in the state of Oregon right now, you need to meet a certain benchmark standard in English language arts, math, and in writing. So it's really reading, writing, and math. And you need to demonstrate that. And one of the ways that you can demonstrate that is by meeting the benchmark on the Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills. Now, Oregon is fairly unique in that there are multiple ways that a student can demonstrate reaching this benchmark. There are other assessments that they can demonstrate scores on to meet the benchmark, including the SAT, the ACT, Work Keys, which is a different kind of assessment, Compass, which is another kind of assessment, and then there are also classroom work samples. So I can do the work in the classroom, it goes to the teacher, it's scored, and if I meet the benchmark standard in any of those ways, I can meet my essential skill, but it's one of the ways that we do that. So our assessments are required by both Oregon and federal law, and the State Board of Education adopts the content standards. That is, this is the set of standards that we want students to learn. And then they also have adopted assessments, and we should have assessments that really do test against that set of knowledge that we expect students to know and to have. And so you would adopt the standards. This is what we want students to know and be able to do, and then an assessment that would match those standards so we know if students do know them or if they're able to do them. And so that would be the way that we go about that. OAKS is what we call our assessment system, and it's managed by the Oregon Department of Ed. So OAKS is the Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills is an online assessment. So students take it at the computer. It's what's called computer adaptive, which Oregon was the first state that had a computer adaptive engine that was approved by the U.S. Department of Education. And it means that when a student does a test problem, if they get it right, they typically get the next question is going to be a little bit harder. And if they get it wrong, the next question will be a little bit easier. And so it adapts to their knowledge set. And there are two really good things about computer adaptive assessments. One is that it takes fewer test questions to really identify what the knowledge set of the student is because it adapts and kind of finds that appropriate place. And the other is it allows you to identify a much broader spectrum of knowledge and skills that the student knows. And so a regular standardized test that tests in a very narrow band set of knowledge can tell you if the student is inside of it or outside of it, but cannot really describe with very great definition where they exist if they're outside sort of that standard norm. On computer adaptive, we can go way out and identify where students sit within a much bigger continuum. And so that's an important piece of information for us to understand at many times. And again, it requires fewer test questions. We have had assessments that have been open from January through June, which is very unusual. Really, some of our assessments are open from October through June, so that students, the testing window opens up, and any time that a student sits down in front of the computer to take the assessment, they can do that. Our English language arts and math assessments have allowed students to take the assessment multiple times. I think it's part of the reason that when we talk about how much time students in Oregon spend taking tests, that it oftentimes can seem as being inappropriate because there can be so much time that's spent taking a test. And so if I don't pass, or even if I did pass the English language arts assessment, I met the benchmark, if I wanted to, I could take it again. And in fact, if my parent wrote a note to the school and said, I'd like my child to take it again, they could take it a third time. And so they've been able to take it up to as many as three times, and if there are multiple assessments in any given year, that can be a lot of assessments if you total them all up. Our new assessment that begins this spring, the Smarter Balance Assessment, is not that way. You can only take it once, and that testing window will be from March to June 12th. So a much tighter assessment window, and that's in English language arts and in math. And you may only take the assessment one time. So currently we offer assessments in math, English language arts, writing, social studies, and science. And so there are multiple different ones. We also are involved, I think this is important for people to know, in what's called the redevelopment of the English Language Proficiency Assessment, ELPA, or ELPA. People call it the ELPA 21. And the Oregon Department of Education received a $9.1 million federal grant, obviously from the federal government, in combination with 11 other states, and we are the lead state to develop a new English Language Proficiency Assessment. It's an assessment that is used to determine the level of language proficiency in English that a student has who's not an English first speaker. So if you have an English language learner or an ELL student we often refer to, they would take the English language proficiency assessment. It would tell us where they are on their continuum as far as English language acquisition. And students would take that at the end of each year to determine their current status. And if they get to a certain point, then they're exited from ELL programs.
Rob, with the ELPA, is it adapted to the 150 languages spoken in, or just the major ones?
It is my understanding.
I wanted to point out the 150 languages that are spoken in Oregon.
Yes, Chair Doherty. Yeah. My understanding of it is that it's adaptable so that it can be given, and that any student from any different language background could take it, and we would understand their proficiency.
Thank you.
That's a very important component. And part of the reason that we're redoing this work is because with the adoption of the Common Core, we need to have assessments that line up to that standard as well. Just so you have an idea of the volume of the number of assessments that we're delivering on a yearly basis, you can see that the English language arts students, all students in grades 3 through 8, so 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th, and grade 11 take that assessment, and that is 294,000 students. Some students take it twice, and so you could start to imagine very quickly that there are 300,000 or 400,000 of those assessments given just in English language arts. Math is the same. Social science in grades 5, 8, and 11, and there are 128,000 students there, but really a much smaller subset of students take the social science assessment. It's optional. You can take it if you, you can have your students take it if they, or you want them to. So we have about, I think, 15,000 students that take that assessment, and then the others are required, and you can see the numbers that are there. So we're moving to a new assessment this year, and so I wanted to talk about that just really briefly. And again, the reason that we're doing that is because we have a new set of standards in English language arts and in math, and that's the only place where we have a new assessment in those two subjects. And so in 2010, the State Board of Education adopted the Common Core Standards. The Common Core Standards are a set of standards that really are more challenging than the standards we've had previously in the state of Oregon and are targeted to ensure that by the time a student reaches 12th grade that they're college and career ready. And then there really is a backtracking of that set of standards. Here's what you need to know and be able to do as a 12th grader to be deemed college and career ready. So if that's the case, what learning would have to take place in that 12th grade year? So what are the standards in 11th, 10th, 9th, 8th, all the way down to kindergarten and perhaps beyond? And so that's what the Common Core standards are, and then we have a set of assessments now, or the Common Core assessment, that districts are implementing that would judge against that, and that assessment is called the Smarter Balance Assessment. So the Smarter Balance Assessment was adopted in 2013 by the State Board. There is lots of question about, what does this look like, and is there a concern about whether or not we'd actually be able to deliver this? And has it ever been done before, and what did the results look like? And so what I would want you to know is that there was a field test conducted at Smarter Balance last spring, and that there were 4.2 million students across the nation that took it. So there are currently, I think, 19 states that are all part of the Smarter Balance Consortium. California is one of those. All students in California took the assessment last year. In Oregon, it was 24,000 students. Students in Idaho and other states across the nation took it, 2.4 million, and again, 24,000 just in Oregon. It is grades 3 through 8 and 11 in English language arts and math. And this is a different assessment than the old Oaks assessment, the old Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills assessment, which was completely multiple choice. And this assessment is not. There is some multiple choice that's computer adaptive. There also is some short answer, and then there are two performance tasks, so a writing performance task and a math performance task. And so it's a much more in-depth assessment, and it requires, besides just the multiple choice test, you can score obviously with a computerized, but the other parts of the assessment need to be hand scored by people, mm-hmm. because the variability in the answers and deeming whether or not they're correct or that they're well written or well argued really requires
a person. I read someplace that some third graders don't know keyboarding, and so is this going to be an issue with the Smarter Balance with some of the kids that may not know how to keyboard that have to type the stuff in?
Yes, Chair Doherty, thank you. Good question. So, yes.
Counting spelling.
There are, pardon?
Are we counting spelling?
I believe that you can use the word check.
Okay.
So there is an expectation that third graders are going to be able to keyboard in order to take the assessment. And I know that there's been a number of studies that have been done about that and whether or not third graders typically are able to keyboard to this level. And we're very comfortable that the answer is yes. And so really the only other things that I have here are a couple of questions. One of the things that people, when they talk about both the Common Core standards, which are a much deeper set of standards, and then also the assessment, and is that the assessment is one that looks quite a bit different than what we had before, and that the questions are going to be much deeper and require a synthesis of information. So you need to tie a bunch of different things together to really be able to answer. And so these are different kinds of questions than what we've seen on our assessment previously. And I know that the writing there is fairly small, but this is a fifth grade English language arts item, and it is one where you would read what's on the left, and you need to be able to scroll down to read all of that. Not all the information you need to answer the question is apparent on the screen. And it really talks about hermit crabs, what they do, that there's a shortage of hermit crab shells out there in the world for various and sundry reasons. And then it asks some questions of the student, and they're instructed to do some typing where they answer what's happening with some artificial shells that are being used for hermit crabs. And one of the things that you'll see, and that it will be very consistent in this work, is they'll ask the student to back up the information, to basically say, to create some argumentation about where did I read this, how do I know that what I'm saying is accurate and true, so that there is a real need to be able to read that for content and create some argumentation in your answer.
Okay, Representative Wilson, did you have a question?
I'd like to make a statement, Chair, when Mr. Saxton might be a little bit further along.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm almost done, thank you. And then I also wanted to show you this math question. This is kind of an interesting math question, and it is one where it talks about some classes, six classes of 26 students at Maria's school that are going on a bus trip, and that the school district has ordered three buses, and Maria's concerned that three buses are not going to do the work there. And so you're supposed to identify here if there are any inappropriate or inaccurate statements within the four A, B, C, and D statements, and then exactly how many people would be taking the trip.
There's nothing here, like kids have to run on the side, along the side of the bus.
No, it could be our new PE and exercise program. But what you'll find in here is that there's an assumption that there are six teachers that are going to go along. And so there is an expectation that the student's going to be able to identify, oh, and there needs to be room for the teachers as well. Unless, of course, Chair Doherty would suggest that they be those who exercise. But I don't think that's a good idea.
Okay.
And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Questions, comments? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Didn't get a chance really to digest the draft here about the recommendations for creating a highly effective assessment system. And when we have more time with that, I'd like to go back and revisit that. One of the beauties of the legislative process is that on an education committee in Salem, you can welcome a small-town business guy who just measures his success by the fact that you've got more money than expenses at the end of the month. And so it's pretty easy for us to tell whether we've been successful or not. But a couple of things, as just a small-town business guy listening to what I've listened to so far, it's enough to make your head explode, you know, to really soak all of this in. When, in my own simplistic way, I thought that teaching was about teachers loving to teach and measuring that or teaming that up with a child's insatiable appetite to learn. And it is incredible to me what I'm hearing here. It's just a mind blower because the product apparently is, well, it just looks to me like there's a rebellion in your customer base. And that is that a ton of people that I know and respect, including teachers, are using words to describe what's going on here. Overwhelmingly stressful. Testing narrows the curriculum. Stressful. Demoralizing. Children in tears. You know, that doesn't sound like education to me. It seems, well, it's just something I don't recognize. I don't understand. And so I just have to say that when we move along here, I'm really excited and fascinated about sinking my teeth into this, because for me in my life, it is fairly easy to recognize what success is. And it looks to me like you guys are wrapped around the capstan here. This is so complicated. It's incredible. And it seems to me that even considering the social and societal issues of today, educating kids has to be a whole lot more simple than this is being portrayed. And when I do hear about kids in tears and looking forward, and I shouldn't even use the term looking forward, being absolutely terrified about upcoming testing, high-stakes testing, and things like that, this has developed a certain level of confusion and brutality that I, as a taxpayer, just have to say, my goodness, what in the world is going on here? And then I look at the absentee rate and I look at the graduation rate, and it only reinforces my thinking. The product has real problems here. And so I'm hoping that somehow along the way we can get control of this thing. And believe me, it is nothing between you and I, because I don't really know you. We haven't met. I don't know how long you've been involved in anything. Maybe you're not involved in this long slide. But, you know, one thing that made a huge impression on me was New Math when I was in grade school. And it made a huge impression on me because it destroyed my confidence in mathematics, and I never regained it again. And so there has just been, to me, one experiment after another with these poor kids in the Petri dish, and I just feel sorry for these guys, you know? And so I hope that if we really love kids like I think we do, that we'll start remembering them in this process. It's a sad situation to me, and I'm really glad I'm here to be given the privilege of even talking like this. So thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your indulgence.
Well, it is. I think this is the idea of this testing. This is not just a one hearing or a one issue. I mean, this goes back to No Child Left Behind, where apparently the only way that we had accountability as to whether people were successful was by a test score. So it's kind of gone from there. Would you like to respond to that, or just?
Chair Doherty, about the only thing that I would say in response is simply that the document that you have in front of you that Nancy gave to mm-hmm. you, and then the 16-page document that I hope that you all actually will take the opportunity to read, I think is a really nice document that acknowledges some of our concerns about where we are in assessment in the state of Oregon, and says we absolutely believe that there really are three very important components of assessment, and that each of those needs to be implemented smartly and in equal measure, and that we need to be careful that we don't ever overemphasize or de-emphasize one of those legs of the assessment stool, and that oftentimes if we spend too much time, too much money, or too much effort on any one of those, we're out of balance, the pendulum has swung too far, and we need to stop that motion and start to make sense out of it and make sure that we do have balance, and that a de-emphasis of the summative assessment is an important thing for us to do in the state, but that we need to do it really wisely, because the data that I showed you at the beginning of this presentation today is important data. Mm-hmm. And it's stuff that we all need to know if we're going to be thoughtful and use feedback about where we exist, how we should invest, where we're making headway, where we're not making headway, and where big systems, district-sized systems and school-sized systems, are having incredible success as compared to others, so that we can replicate that and use their really good work to make a difference so that more students can be successful.
Very good. Any questions? Representative Reno.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Doherty. Mr. Saxon, I would concur with a lot of the things Representative Wilson said, and me being a small businessman in a small town at the other end of the state, some of the things that were up on the board earlier, where you had two districts, one measured 75%, one measured 50%, these were from testing in Oregon with the Oaks test. Now, if we were to take some of the other states that are performing well in education and go to them and give them the same Oaks test, or take their testing and bring it to our kids and do that in a, you know, you're not just going to do it in one district, you're going to do it in a good group to get a good average, you know, to say where are we in education, where are they in education, and some of the other states that are doing quite well, rather than, you know, it does seem like Representative Wilson said, we're kind of what they call in the computer industry on the bleeding edge, and you're always trying something new to get a result, or you're always working on the R&D, but the product that you're trying to produce may or may not come about. And so I think when the taxpayer does have a huge investment in this process and in the product that we get, it would seem like we would want to do that research, not just in Oregon, but comprehensively in the rest of the states.
Chair Doherty, Representative Barreto, thank you for that point, and it's a really good one. It is, you know, we have always had this Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills, and we give it, and then we try to figure out, well, how does that relate to any other assessment? So one of the really big pieces of work that we've tried to do is to relate it to the NAEP, the National Assessment of Education Progress, that is given across the nation on a sampling basis, and see how do we stack up in comparison with that. And it's a really hard thing to do and to compare and to draw very good conclusions about. So one of the things that we are pleased about as we're headed into this spring and we're giving the Smarter Balance assessment for the first time is that there are 19 other states in the Smarter Balance Consortia, and that we'll be able to compare our results to all 19 other states that are in the consortia and say, how do we stack up compared to others, and are there some states that are doing a better job than we are? And are there some things that we can glean from that? In addition, I think there are about 15 states in a similar consortia that's called the PARC consortia, and it's just a different test, one of two consortia tests. And there'll be a very easy to draw a comparison between the Smarter Balance and PARC, so we actually could compare ourselves to about 44 other states across the nation when this work is done at the end of this spring, and we should have the results by July of this upcoming year. And so it'll give us a chance to do some comparisons that we've never been able to do before. There'll be a lot of discussion, I'm sure, at some point in time. This is a little bit further afield than what your statement was, about what our level setting has been for whether or not a student is meeting kind of this federal level of passing on this new assessment. So there will be a state level and then this sort of national or federal level. And what we've tried to do is make that at a real college and career readiness standard, so that we know that if a student is able to demonstrate this kind of success on the assessment, that we can do some backtracking from some of our old assessments and know that were the student to go on to college, there'd be a 65% likelihood that the student would get a B minus or higher in their same freshman college course. So if this is an English language arts and I go to take a college course in English and I've met the benchmark on the Smarter Balance, there's a 65% likelihood I'll get a B minus or higher. That's the same percent of likelihood that the ACT and the SAT set on their college and career readiness benchmark. And so there is a tying together of lots of different assessment here and trying to make sense out of the results that we get and what it means for kids and what it means about our system.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Superintendent Rob, good to see you again.
Good to see you as well.
I will be talking about this a little bit more later when we talk about the bills, but I want to first of all thank you. I know how much work you put into this. I also know your background and the kind of time you've spent both in the classroom and at the superintendent level, at the local superintendent level, so I appreciate that. He would be able to keep up with the bus, by the way, just so that you know.
Yes, he could. Are you still running every morning at like 2:30 in the morning or something?
There are some significant concerns that I have, and you've heard them from me before, but I want to first of all, point out that the expectation that I've heard is that we expect to see 60 to 70% of the students fail this year. That is not in my, and I'll go into this a little bit further, but that is not in my view the kind of test I would have given as a teacher to have 30% of the students succeed. So that is a concern that I have, and as we look at these tests, it seems out of balance, if you will, pardon the pun, regarding these particular tests. I would like for you to speak to two things. The Smarter Balance tests and the summative tests that you're talking about are often given at the end of the school year. So in other words, the students, the individual students, get no help. You don't, that you can't find out what they need the help with. The ALPA, the other test that you mentioned, is given at the beginning of the year so that we have a sense of what the students need. Individual students need, not just in, not just the sort of general things. A number of tests in the past were also sample driven. So rather than having every student take them, you got a sense of what a general program was taking place in a school or a district and how well it was succeeding. That seems to be a problem. It causes a problem for me because it means that we really aren't paying attention to what the student needs. We're paying attention to what a district or a statistical sampling needs. So that's a concern of mine. I understand why we may want to use this, but I will bring this up a little bit later on. But I'd like to have your response to that, those particular concerns.
Sure. Chair Doherty, Representative Frederick, and please cut me off whenever you're...
I was going to say, we've got a lot of people going through, and we've got an hour to get everybody through. So
I shouldn't have asked the question.
Yeah, we have we have no wiggle room for time at the end. So.
Okay.
But so please
love to respond
continue.
To the question. So it is true that a summative assessment really is what I would call a postmortem assessment, right? It's end of the year, student takes a test, you say, how do we do?
Yeah.
And it very much is a systems assessment. Or I do think that as a parent, when I look at what my child's score is against the benchmark, it tells me something, right? And if my child was below the benchmark, I would say, that's a concern for me. What are we going to do to make sure that that's not the case? Because it indicates to me that my child is not on track to be college and career ready, and I'm concerned about it, right? So at an individual level. Now, we need to be really careful with these summative assessments about what their proper use is and whether or not you can make lots of individual student decisions using them, right? But I think that a lot of parents look at those results, and that's where they go. And as a parent, I'm sure that that's exactly where I would go. And if my child looked like they needed some additional help, I'd begin to try to get it for them. When we talk about the different kinds of assessment, it wouldn't be appropriate for us to give this kind of assessment at the start of the year and then at the end of the year because it is a summative assessment. We're trying to figure out what students have learned over the course of a year. If I wanted to do that, I would be looking at more of an interim kind of an assessment where I would give that to them and then progress monitor over the course of the year and see how they're coming along against that. ELPA is a little bit like that. And so making sure that we use the assessments, the different kinds of assessment as is appropriate, I think is a really important component of this.
Chair Doherty.
I want to give you a quick example of Tiger Tualatin School District just because it's the one I'm most familiar with.
And you like bragging about it.
Well, sometimes.
Yeah, they work very hard in Tiger Tualatin.
Either bragging or just, sort of putting in the room something that in my experience really happened. And that is that we would get these summative assessments at the end of the year. And then I would say to principals, I need you to put together information about the outcomes that you had at your school this year. And when we get together on August 1st, we're going to review what it is that you found out as a result of the assessment, the summative assessment that you gave about your school. I want to know, how well did students do in general? How well did students of color do? And if we disaggregate that, how well did students who are in poverty do? And I want to know how your school did as compared with other similar schools within the district and even those that are dissimilar. Because what I would find is that we could bring that together and principals could make that presentation and they could listen to one another and we could say, so are there any indicators about the results that we got as a district that we can identify that we're not doing as well as we should be doing? And is there something that we can do about it around staff development in the upcoming year, around an investment of resource, an adoption of curricula? Is there something that's missing that would help us improve as a result of the data that we just got? And is there something that's happening at this school that's different? Or should we think about sending more resource and money to this school because it looks like there is an achievement gap that unless we do that, we're never going to be able to deal with? And so it allowed us to make really informed decisions and to improve the kinds of outcomes that we were able to get. It also told us that in third grade reading, we needed to be a lot better than we were and that we needed to focus on staff development there and training and the number of staff that we put there and that we needed to make sure that we adopted curricula and that we gave training around equity-based practices and equity-based pedagogy, teaching practices, so that we could work on closing the achievement gap. And I will do my brag now. We went from 85% of our students reading at grade level district-wide to 93.5% mm-hmm. over the course of 6 years. And we closed the achievement gap by 25 percentage points because we were intentional about it in third grade reading. And we were able to do that because we had assessment results that told us something in a postmortem. But we could use them to plan what we were going to do in our upcoming year.
I said one thing. Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Saxon, wouldn't it be fair to say also, though, that part of the assessment along the way comes in with the PLCs? And then that does give teachers an opportunity to assess students along the way if they're utilizing the PLCs, if districts are taking advantage of that?
Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, yes. The professional learning teams or PLTs or PL something, right?
It's on our list of
a professional learning team of teachers that looks at the data that they're receiving. So if you get the third grade teachers together at a school and say, hey, what'd your assessment results look like on the Oaks? And they think about that, and they do some planning about, if it appears that there's a hole in some of their argumentation or whatever it might happen to be, that they can work to address that in their planning and how they're going to go about teaching. But even better than that is when there's some common formative assessments or common interim assessments where on a regular basis an assessment's given and the team comes together and says, what happened here? How did your students do on this quiz that we just took? And, hey, if the outcomes that you got are better than the ones I got, what did you do? Show me that lesson that you taught. Teach me about that. I want to be better. Or, hey, everybody, look at what my kids did. Let me tell you how that happened. Mm-hmm. And so those are really good feedback mechanisms, but those are two of the other parts of the really important assessment stool and one that we've neglected in the state of Oregon. We haven't spent resource on it. We haven't trained on it to the level that we need to because we have a really big leg that's called summative and two little spindly legs that are called formative and interim, and we need to balance that up. And that's part of what the recommendations that you're going to see from our committee will say.
Great.
Thank you. Anything else? Rob, thank you very much.
Closing
informational hearing on testing and assessment. I'm going to open a public hearing on 2680 and turn the gavel over to Representative Frederick for a moment. One thing, we do have an hour to get through about 28 people that have signed up. So when we do have public testimony, if you have public testimony, please don't read it. We have it. And add about a minute or less to your information, because we read it, we have it. It's all on OLIS.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2680 prohibits the use of statewide summative assessments developed by state-led consortium to establish summative ratings of schools or to make summative evaluations of teachers or administrators. It directs the Superintendent of Public Instruction to convene a work group related to statewide summative assessments developed by the state-led consortium. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Doherty.
Okay.
Let's go right ahead.
Okay, Vice Chair Frederick, members of the committee, I'm Mark Doherty. I'm House Representative for House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And I actually represent three school districts, Tigard, Tualatin, Beaverton, and Portland is my area. We're here to talk about 2680, and it does two things. It prohibits the use of summative tests, and that's, after the lesson's been done, the test results for the 2014-15 school year to rate schools or evaluate teachers. And second, it directs the Superintendent of Public Instruction to convene a work group, which they have, to evaluate our systems of assessment on from top to bottom and determine how we can design it. So part of the bill is already in the works. The other part hasn't. But when we talk about testing, and granted, I only taught for 11 years, but and worked with schools for another 22. But there are too many tests. And on an average nationwide, from kindergarten to 12th grade, students take 113 standardized tests in that time period. And many times they're written by the test companies in doing this, yet it is just standard practice that every teacher goes through, and we do formative testing. And it's not necessarily the test that you'd have some person from Harvard put out. It could be as simple as when I taught Julius Caesar and I had the students to say, please summarize Act 1. And I had about six of them that said, and the soothsayer said, beware the eyes that march. And right at that point, I figure, I do not think I got across the point what Ides were. And so I have to go through and explain that Ides is the 15th of the month, and this is when Julius Caesar was. So we finally got it back. But the test that I gave, you know, told me that. There are other things in testing that you really can't test. How do you test a student that I had that came in and wrote horrible paragraphs in English, and every other word is a profanity? And so after we worked on this and so on and so forth, at the end of the quarter, he wrote a pretty good paragraph. He could identify that the profanity that he no longer used, he knew when it was a verb, an adjective, or an adverb, and so on. But that's not something you could test. He went from here to here, and that's not something you could test. But the teacher knew that this student moved. So we hear constantly, and we've, you know, experienced firsthand how teachers have been forced to redirect a lot of their energies towards testing. And studies are coming out that maybe one-fourth of their time, instruction time, is used to prepare for some of these tests. So parents and students and teachers, administrators are afraid, and I think with real good reason, that results of many of the high-stakes tests will be misused in a way that harms either themselves or the school. So the whole purpose of this bill is to go through, and let's do a little more of the Oregon way. We're already starting with what Dr. Golden talked about, and so we want to make sure that assessments are used to guide students for learning as opposed to interfering with it.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. First of all, I would like to say that if you look at the...
Yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Introduce yourself, please. Thank you.
I'm Susan McLean, Representative McLean, and I'm from Western Washington County. And I have been a teacher for 42 years, and I just retired in June. And I wanted you to look at the handout that were given by Dr. Golden. And if you look at the 12th recommendation, the 12th recommendation is exactly what this piece of legislation does. It, as has already been pointed out by our chair, it prohibits these test results from 2014 and 15 to actually be used to rate the schools or evaluate the teachers. As was pointed out by Deputy Superintendent Mr. Saxton, this is a transitional year. And even though there was a small program of 24,000 students that took the new test last year, there really are some transitional issues. And we really do need to have an opportunity for schools and school districts and teachers and also the students who will be taking the test to really have an opportunity to really have that test happen in a way that it's not as, I think Deputy Superintendent Saxton indicate, high-risk testing. Because at this point, the schools and the teachers and the students are all feeling that stress because of this transitional year and not really having enough time to really work on what this really means as far as part of the testing in the state of Oregon. We, as has been indicated, this last weekend I met with teachers in Washington County, and it was a meeting that we're going to be doing about once a month. And one of the items that was indicated to us in some of the testimony when we were having our coffee was that one of the teachers alone was losing 18 days to prepare for this test that's going to be given between March and May. 18 days. And that means 18 days less time to actually work on the curriculum. So again, as the Deputy Superintendent pointed out, we've got three parts of our teaching model. We have what we're teaching, we have how we're teaching it, and then we test it to see how well the students are understanding the concepts. And so right now, because it's a high-risk test and could possibly be used as a report card or as a graduation requirement or as a some kind of a requirement to get the student to the next level, it has really come out as being that high-risk test. issue. And so I do, I want you to know that in the 42 years that I've taught, of course we need goals. Of course we need to be able to have data. I'm a speech and debate coach for 43 years. And we need that data. We need to understand what the test means in evaluation. But there is some frustration right now in the schools. There's some frustration by the teachers and the students as far as having to work into this new system too quickly. And what this piece of legislation does is basically give us an opportunity to do that transition in a smoother and a better way. And I am ecstatic about the workforce that Dr. Golden was talking about and those 12 recommendations, which I know we're going to hear more about as they become finalized. But let's look at number 12 again and realize that it gives an opportunity for this workforce to actually come up with some finalized issues, and it gives us an opportunity to slow it down and really make sure that we've got everything in place to make this a successful program.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. We have a number of people who have signed up to speak, and I'm just going to actually just go down the list as they signed up. So Rex Higgins, Chris Allman, and Laura Pazantz-Kluth. How badly did I destroy that word? Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty, Deputy Vice Chair Frederick, members of the committee.
Okay, and again, I'm going to remind you about time so everybody can speak. Okay.
Okay. Quickly as you can.
Quickly as I can. Well, I probably thought I was going to be the skunk at the garden party here, but I see I am not. And I would just like to encourage Representative Wilson and others that are concerned about what's happening in our schools with these tests. I happen to have my PhD from the University of Iowa, which next to Princeton is a testing center of the universe. So I worked with testing people all the way through, and I was here to tell you that I used to be built more like Dr. Saxton than I am now, but they beat me down with all this stuff and bred me out, and what you see is what's left. Words like joy and enthusiasm, so on, do not follow from testing. We're way in over our heads. The one thing I would say about this bill, and I also happen to have the opportunity to work for years with Dr. Stiggins, who they're working with, and his performance testing stuff is wonderful. It fits in with instruction. But what I don't understand and do not believe is how the high-stakes SBAC tests have any place in this thing, and I am concerned that this bill lets them live when you should drive a stake through their heart right now. You have my testimony. I could say more. I'd love to talk to more people about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
My name is Chris Allman, for the record, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. I am in support of House Bill 2680. I look at the politics nationally of what's happening with the reauthorization of NSCA, and I think about the politics that have left us where we are right now in this muddle of trying to do politically to move forward, because we have a test that's completely unknown and the high stakes are continuing to remain. So therefore, I support this. I want to point out that the Network for Public Education calls on Congress to end the federal mandate for annual standardized testing. We have a lot to see what's going to happen from them, and I think a moratorium would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I'm Laura Paxson-Kluth, and I'm a 21-year veteran of Lake Oswego High School. I recently read Professor Yong Zhao's excellent book, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Dragon? Why China Has the Best and the Worst Education System in the World. And it's a timely warning to America about China's educational flaws, not the least of which is their over-fondness for testing. Zhao's thesis is that the testing is a result of China's Confucian past to promote conformity, not creativity, and it serves to prop up authoritarian regimes, not democracies. I really am anxious to get rid of the phrase college and career ready. There are a lot of paths to college and career readiness or successful life. My own very low SAT scores would be ample evidence, because I went on to graduate from Reed College, I went to the Peace Corps, and I have a master's in history from University of Oregon. But I'd like to end on a high note. Would you investigate the full-scale cost of this type of testing, and not just in loss of instructional time, but in the educational profiteering which exists to support these tests. But I would like to end with an anecdote about what is really positive, the true meaning of education. Last week, I had the good fortune to have a Cold War debate in my classroom with my U.S. history juniors. They were either Clark Clifford or Henry Wallace, and they were advising me, Harry S. Truman, what to do about the Soviet Union in the early years of the Cold War. They had to read primary source documents and the textbook. They developed their arguments using evidence from those texts, and they stood and they delivered. It was passionate. They had civil discourse. They are a model of what every adult would want to see in a classroom. Poof. It was magic, and it's gone. It's not testable. It's not quantifiable. Even if I had videotaped it, you would not be able to capture it. Students who had never spoken before stand and spoke with passion. Students who regularly speak stepped up their game. It was absolutely an incredible moment. Every student was drawn into that debate because they were drawn in by the ambient excitement of hammering out their ideas on the anvils of their classmates' arguments as well. That is education. That is why I teach. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Laura. Okay, any questions of this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Deborah Barnes, Hannah Vandering, and Diane Madison. Madison. Or Madison. Thank you, ladies.
I guess we'll get started. I know you're tight on time. I'm Deborah Barnes. I am the president of the North Clackamas Education Association, representing about 850 educators. I have been a teacher for the past 20 years. You've got my testimony, but the bottom line for me is, if you want to talk about real assessment, that's what we do in our classes every day. My students decided to chip in $50, and it competed at the All-American High School Film Festival this year. A real assessment is that we beat those teens from New York and California and picked up first place in the nation in one of the categories. That's assessment for $50. I work at Sabin Schellenberg Center, the state's largest professional technical high school in the state of Oregon, where every day kids have hands-on learning, where they look at each other and realize that what they're learning in class is meaningful: manufacturing, electronics, childcare, law enforcement, fire science. That's where we should be investing our dollars, where kids learn real trades. College and career ready? That's college and career ready. A piece of paper with a test that takes numerous hours for our teachers to get ready for those kids to take, and numerous moments where those kids sit there and take a test. I think about that one kid who's never worked on a computer before, whose parents don't have the money to have a computer or the internet. And we're asking them to take a test on that kind of technology. That's not right, that's not fair, and that's not what we do in Oregon. We want to support our kids and our students, so anything that steps in that way, yes, the teachers behind me, the union leaders beside me, we will stand up for those kids, because that's what we do for a living. And anybody that stands in front of us, we'll do whatever it takes to stop them. Thank you for considering this bill. It's so important right now.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Hannah Vandering. I'm an elementary physical education teacher and president of the Oregon Education Association. And today I want to talk a little bit about the realities, which I think Representative Wilson outlined very clearly, and about a better way to promote student learning in our schools. This is about our students. The current use of assessments in our schools is fundamentally flawed. From the billions of dollars that we're spending on high-stakes standardized tests to the anxiety and stress that's caused, the students sitting in front of the computer crying, and the culture of failure we are about to put in motion with the implementation of the Smarter Balanced Assessment. We're definitely on the wrong track. OEA and our members have been advocating for changes in assessments since No Child Left Behind was adopted, to no avail. We believe it's time to take action, and we believe that Oregon is the perfect place to take that action. I could spend a lot more time talking about the inhumanity and the ineffectiveness of the current system, but none of us sitting here today can change the past, but you in your capacity on the Education Committee and us working together with you, parents and students, we can create a better future, and one where assessments are used to really impact student learning. House Bill 2680 will ensure the Smarter Balance results are not used to evaluate teachers or administer our schools. We need to also take away the high stakes which are on our students coming out with this test. Our students need to understand that the results of these tests will not be used as the sole measure of their accomplishments or their learnings, that we will use this to evaluate. We have to evaluate whether this assessment or any other standardized assessment truly measures the standards of which they're supposed to measure. I'm really excited that Dr. Golden has shared with you today the recommendations that are coming forward from a group of 16 real-life educators that work in our schools every day. Administrators have helped along the way as well, working with Dr. Stiggins, Dr. David Connolly out of EPIC, and using research from not only within the United States but also around the world on assessments. We believe that our recommendations are recommendations that need to be vetted clearly out in public with parents, students, other stakeholders, but we look forward to vetting those and creating a system of assessment that truly honors student learning and puts that love of learning back in our classrooms and our schools that has been taken away. House Bill 2680 gives us this opportunity to start the journey. I thank you for the work that you're doing today, and I look forward to working with you to create that new system.
Thank you, Hannah. Hey, Diane.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony today. You have my written testimony, but I want to highlight two things.
And if you could identify yourself, please, for the record.
Oh, that's a good thing. I'm Diane Madison Nottage. I've been teaching for 25 years in Oregon. I currently work at Hamlin Middle School in Springfield. 2 points. I'm going to tell you a story about a student, eighth grade struggling reader, came to my language arts class, was not a natural reader. I'm not a reader. I can't read. Over the course of that year, he made huge strides. He sat down to take the Oaks test. I watched him that day as he clicked the final button to end the test, and his score popped up. He looked at me, his face fell, and he left the classroom. He'd missed the mark by 2 percentage points. All that data is going to show you is that he's a failure. What it's not going to show you is that he had improved 14 points from the year before. Where are you going to find that? You're not in the current assessment system. Second, we have a huge truancy problem in Oregon. What's the problem with truancy? They're not in the classroom. And yet, this test is going to take minimum 7.5 hours to complete. That equates to 10-plus class periods out of a core instructional area. I see that as a problem. I don't see that the return on the investment for these assessments are giving us what we need. As one of those living, breathing teachers who helped craft those 12 recommendations, I'm excited about the work that we do, and I think that's the direction we need to go. I so appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions to this panel?
Just a quick question. The number that you mentioned, that 16 folks participated in the work group, where were they from?
Those members were from all across the state, and they represented different groups of students. We had ELL teachers, special education teachers. We had classroom teachers from each one of the levels. We reached out to make sure that in that spectrum, we had people who had worked on creating the Smarter Balance and people who had great concerns about the Smarter Balance, so that this group brought forward the very best recommendations to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, that's all we have signed up for this one. Anyone else on 2680? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2680 and open up a concurrent public hearing on House Bill 2713, 2714, and 2715. And Representative Frederick. And the reason we're doing all of these bills together, they're all fairly similar, all brought by one person. So we're, unless there's something specific about a certain bill number, we're going to be hearing all three of them. That's been up there for a while.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, House District 43, that's North and Northeast Portland. I'm here to introduce the issues associated with this group of bills, and especially to suggest the questions that should be asked, not just about the bills, but about the educational dynamic that inspired them. 2 years ago, I was before this committee with House Bill 2664, similar to this year's House Bill 2713. My request was and remains pretty straightforward. I want to see an honest evaluation of the costs and benefits of these changes. What is the impact of mandatory high-stakes testing on education programs and educational environments in Oregon? What is better for it and what is worse? The educational environment in Oregon's public schools has changed, and the imposition of mandatory high-stakes tests is a driver. I simply asked, and I'm asking again, for a comprehensive review of these effects. We have all heard stories. They're often dismissed as anecdotal. To undergo such a radical change without an honest evaluation of whether it makes anything better is, to me, unconscionable. The Oregon Department of Education has submitted testimony that, pertaining to the fiscal, administrative, and educational impacts of tests on schools, will require significant research and time for both the department and school districts. It's really pretty amazing to me that we would make radical changes to the school environment without that information. But that is what has happened. You will hear testimony from parents and teachers about what the effects have been already, and their anticipation that these effects will intensify as implementation progresses. We have heard why the tests are mandatory. It's because they are mandated by the NCLB waiver, by state adoptions, whatever. To call this a circular reasoning is actually a bit generous. What is not answered is this regimen an educational best practice? If we can't talk about the effects on teaching and learning, then we can't make good decisions about policies. And the second question has to be, are the tests being implemented assessment best practices? 2 years ago, I warned about heading down this road without these answers, and here we are, with both the tests and the high stakes attached to them upon us. And that is why this time I've also introduced two other bills, 2714, to somewhat loosen the mandatory aspect by clarifying and expanding the option to forego testing and about information available to families, and 2715 to protect students from potential public disclosure of their scores on these tests. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the assumptions that underlie this push to subject our children to unrelenting testing. The assumption that children are empty vessels and that education is the process of filling them. If children were seen as growing, developing minds, growing in response to stimulating opportunities, I believe we would design our whole approach differently. The assumption that the business-generated model of reverse engineering, or backtracking, accurately tells us what a young person should know in order to prepare them for the world about 20 years from now. The assumption that a test score is an outcome or a valid marker of outcomes. The assumption that shortcomings in educational achievement result from lack of measurement or from failures of students or teachers to work hard enough. The assumption that achievement gaps can be addressed without acknowledging underlying causative factors. Now, in the past 2 years, this issue has become more urgent. The new tests mandated for this year are projected to result in failure rates as high as 70%. That is one of the factors that leads me to ask, does this represent professional best practices for assessment? I'm going to back up a little bit and take a minute to talk about the achievement gaps. When somebody claims that a program will promote equity, or be especially for students of color, or underserved populations, or at-risk students, I am, to say the least, skeptical. For decades, we have seen prescriptions for children of poverty that involve regimented back-to-basics approaches. Then we wring our hands about why they don't respond all that well. Meanwhile, families of means take advantage of the choices they have to ensure that their kids are stimulated to engage in the world as their minds develop. Parents with means do not typically drill their students on the skills needed to pass standardized tests. No, they are the ones at schools and school boards protesting the time spent on them. They don't sign their kids up for back to basics or 3 R's programs. They sign their kids up for enrichment activities. In fact, here are some characteristics of the education of kids of well-off families. The learning day doesn't end when the school day ends. They might play sports or be involved in other activities that challenge them. Their parents sign them up for activities that address not deficiencies in the kids, but deficiencies in the school program. They go to art classes and science classes, or parents design home activities of their own. Parents who have the means spare no expense to make sure their kids have a chance to do interesting things. And learning, the learning year doesn't end when the school year ends. They go to camps and classes and swim lessons. They go home to a warm home and dinner, and even if mom is rushed. Oops, I'm too close. Sorry about that. Even if mom is rushed, I'm sure we could probably extend this list. So when somebody says that they have a program that will help poor children and children of color, I'm going to ask, how does it enrich the hours after school? How does it make sure that they have interesting things to learn and experience every day that make them want to learn more? How does it enrich their summer and their other school vacation times? How does it ensure that they are secure in shelter and food and support? Motivation is notoriously hard to measure, but it's a vital part of the educational process. If we kill motivation, our successes in the measurable world are not likely to matter. Growing minds are living and growing and interacting with the world, and the world they will understand differently from how we understand it, and a world they will shape. Our, and by our I mean their future, depends on not only acquiring knowledge but also growing up. It depends on their having the persistence, the resilience, the curiosity, the maturity, and the moral compass needed to solve problems, as well as knowledge, skills, and abilities. Their survival may depend on solving problems we will never see and can't even imagine. Furthermore, I believe that if we care about their future and happiness and fulfillment, we must care about the quality of the experiences they have now. Ultimately, that's a large part of my concern. Is the focus on outputs, however well or poorly they are defined, simply a diversion that takes our eyes off the inputs? Now, if you're growing tomatoes, you want a good outcome, but it's not magic. It doesn't happen because you keep measuring the plants. In fact, you can have indications that your outcomes are going to be good all along the way, and then find out at the end of the summer that you've grown huge plants with no tomatoes. That's because your inputs weren't the right ones for producing fruit. Tomatoes need light, warmth, fertilizer, and water for good outcomes. And growing children need stimulation, wonder, and excitement, as well as educational content for good outcomes. If we don't focus on high-quality inputs, we're going to be disappointed in our outcomes, no matter what those test scores look like. If the outcome we seek is an innovative and resilient economy and a vibrant and functioning civic and cultural life, then what do the test scores we are pushing for now have to do with it? What do the inputs we are settling for now have to do with it? Those are frankly my questions. So here's what the three bills do. HB 2713 asks for answers to my questions. What are the costs and benefits of state-mandated high-stakes tests, standardized tests? We are often encouraged to embrace change. But change is not always good. Sometimes it's just turmoil. These changes to our public education system affect an entire generation and inflict significant turmoil. How can we continue without knowing whether they provide sufficient benefit to teaching and learning to make that turmoil worth it? We have gone far down the trail of committing resources of time and money to this testing regimen, and as it turns out, far down the trail of allowing it to drive what our students study and how they study it. It is past time to get some hard evidence as to whether we're on the right trail. Because if we're not, every school year is another year going in the wrong direction. This bill simply recognizes that educational policy should be evaluated as to outcomes. It calls for an evaluation of the effects of standardized testing as currently mandated, a cost-to-benefit analysis, if you will. Here in this building, we are pretty fixated on one budget, the one where we decide where to spend our limited dollars. But in a public school classroom, there are several resources that are also on a tight budget. Time, the teacher's attention, the student's attention, everybody's enthusiasm, to name some. When we're thinking about costs versus benefits, those budgets have to be taken into account. Questions about the credibility of the coming consortium tests and their uses give rise to two other bills I proposed. HB 2714 clarifies parents' rights to opt out of these tests. Currently, parents may request exemption on religious grounds. Most of the objections I hear are based on ethical and intellectual reasons, and this bill allows parents to base their decisions on these concerns. The majority of the objections I hear from constituents and professionals are based on the quality of the tests themselves, the validity of their application, and the effects on curriculum and the learning environment. This bill also provides that alternative means of demonstrating proficiency can be used to qualify for a diploma. Now, I want to make it clear that I'm not promoting the idea that a parent should be able to neglect a child's education. I've received communications about exempting homeschooled kids in which the term unschooled is used. That gives me a great pause. I believe that failure to educate a child is neglect bordering on abuse, and anyone who exempts their child from a system that involves licensed teachers and other safeguards has to provide some evidence that the child is, in fact, being educated. Again, the majority of the objections I hear have to do with the educational effects of these tests on public school students. Finally, HB 2715 is intended to address the use of so-called data walls. These are instances in school in which schools have displayed student scores, often in response to a mandate from district administrators. By their nature, such display is available to individuals who have no proper use of the identifiable information, and extends this, the culture of shame and punishment that characterizes much of the push to use test scores for punitive rather than educational purposes. A number of parents and professionals are here to expand on what I've said. One of the most important things we do as decision makers is to look for the rest of the story. The story from the stories from the classroom and the homework desk are immensely important to this debate. When those who are intimately involved in the process raise alarm about what is happening to motivation and educational stimulation, essential inputs, we should pay attention. And finally, because it's me, I want to share a summary of a satire I ran across, which I think I'll be happy to provide as a reprint if you'd like it. It's called All Babies Walking by 6 Months Old. It starts, a group of professional sports teams, owners, and product sponsors decided that the United States was losing ground globally in producing high-quality athletes. So they met with the president and the national secretary of the Department of Sports to convince them to set new athletic policies. Soon after, the RTTS, Race to the Stadium, was established. A committee was selected to write a new and rigorous standard starting from womb to stadium. The new early babyhood common sports state standards were established. Number one, all children shall walk by 6 months old. All children shall run by 6.5 months old. All children shall do somersaults by 7 months old. All children shall do cartwheels by 7.5 months old. It was ensured by adhering to these rigorous standards, all babies would be on track for the Olympics and or professional athleticism. The piece is lengthy and detailed and meticulously paralleling the development of the Common Core State Standards and the measurements used to evaluate and enforce progress on them. I wish I could say that it was just plain ridiculous. Unfortunately, it's not that far of a reach.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Mention will call people all at once. We'll call for all three bills. And so we've got six, seven people on here. We've got about till 2:30. We have another bill that we need to hear today. So we have Steve Buell, Bessie Salter, and Chris Allman, if you want to add to your testimony that we've already presented. We do have it on record. Thank you. Go ahead, Steve.
My name is Steve Buell. I'm a 40-year school teacher, one of the founders of Oregon Save Our Schools, and a member of the Portland School Board, for whom I'm not speaking today. I recently went to the movie Selma, and it occurred to me after seeing that movie, that the reason that they didn't want African Americans to vote is because they wouldn't vote for the power structure. And I'm speaking about HB 2714 today, which is allowing people to opt out. And the reason that I think the power structure in education in Oregon doesn't want to allow people to opt out is because they will. And it's very similar. And by opting out, they're going to expose the power structure to what's really going on. A lot of people are making a lot of money around the testing. People's careers are around the testing. But it doesn't really work for the children. And allowing parents who we allow to do, we allow them to put their children in private school, allow them to put their children in Catholic schools, we allow them to homeschool, and at the same time we allow them to decide what movies they go to, we allow them to decide what they eat, but we're telling parents who are genuinely concerned about their children and the testing that they can't opt their child out except for religious reasons or for disabilities. Now, we argue as a state that that's going to damage the ratings of schools, but when do we put the ratings of schools above the welfare of the children and above good educational practice? We certainly do it. I went for a walk recently with a great nephew, great little kid, terrific, and as an old school teacher, I asked him how he was doing in school, and his answer was, I failed my test. Because that's become the number two thing in education. testing. Right after the approval of the teacher, the second is the testing. And the new test that we have, the SBAC test, on the last, the very last screen, the very last screen says you're a failure to the kid. And if a teacher told that kid that he was a failure and stupid, just like that last screen does, we would all storm those schools. And so I, allowing people to opt out would be a very good idea, I think.
Thank you. Ms. Allman?
Chris Allman, for the record. I'll make it quick on 2715. No-brainer. Get that passed. It's violating FERPA. 2713. I support this bill. I would love to see more cost-benefit analysis beyond summative tests. There's a menu of other standardized tests that are, I believe, disproportionately testing the kids at highest risk. Again, making the quality of education in those settings more likely to be the joyless kind of setting that you have talked about, Chair Doherty. It may be very difficult to try to get that information, and I've recommended, if that would be an administrative burden, that you try to get this information and to get the data so that you're looking at the difference between urban schools that might be large urban schools versus, you know, smaller urban schools, comparing socioeconomic, you know, underperforming schools to higher income schools, and looking at rural school districts as well. We really need to know the cost, the true cost of what is happening in tests, not just at the state level, but at the local level. And I'm going to reserve my comments on opting out to the last bill that's going to be discussed. Thank you.
Betsy?
I'm Betsy Salter. I'm a parent of a PPS ninth grader. And I guess to add to my testimony, I'm here in support of 2714. And I opted our daughter out of the Oaks test in seventh grade and eighth grade. And our principal was very respectful, and it was not a problem. But now that more people are interested in it, our principals and school districts aren't providing accurate information. And so because principals don't want students to be opted out, they're often giving very misleading and inaccurate information in an attempt to intimidate or threaten kind of parents from scaring parents from doing what they feel is best for their student or for whatever their ethical and intellectual reasons mean is for opting out. And so it's, you know, we need parents and teachers and principals to be working together to help our students succeed. And it feels like we're not able to be a team because of the high stakes testing. And I am hoping that high stakes testing will ultimately be eliminated, not just delayed for a year or two. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of this panel? Okay, thank you very much for coming down. Here we have Elizabeth Teal, Bill Porter, and Doug Bridge. And again, we've got one more bill to go, so I'll give you all about 5 minutes. If you want to... Okay, you want to go ahead and start?
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Teal.
It can be 12 inches away.
Okay. I'm a teacher in Portland Public Schools and a parent of two kids in Portland Public Schools. I've been a teacher for 12 years, and my whole career I've been in high poverty schools. And I have seen how testing is hurting schools and students. It's created a culture of fear where principals and teachers and students are all carrying the weight of having to prove their worthiness and ability to proceed going on through test scores. I've seen my students get stripped of resources they used to have, like electives, smaller class sizes, hands-on experiences. As everything has gone towards test scores. I've seen kids literally sick about testing, and I've seen kids who are so demoralized they believe that they are failures when they take tests that tell them that they are. And because of this, as a parent, I cannot submit my child to that test. I can't let her be a part of a system that I've seen, not only because it's going to be harmful to her, but because I understand how harmful it is to the system. And so I am opting her out of testing. And as has been said, right now in Oregon, the law is that parents can only opt out for reasons of religion and disability. And many parents, like myself, are very conflicted about putting our child into a system, submitting them to a test that we know will not help our child, and we also know is hurting public education and undermining it. So I support all of Lou's bills, Representative Frederick's bills, and I also urge you to amend them, to stop penalizing schools when parents do choose to opt out. My children's school, Vernon, has been docked 2 levels on the state report card because of parents opting out. 1 year, five families made the choice not to take the test, and our school was dropped a level. This practice is coercive. It's shaming communities, creating a greater culture of fear where parents are telling other parents what they can and cannot do in their own parent child's interest because it's punishing the school. And our school is in danger of closing, as it has been, because of sanctions related to our waiver and the rating of schools on the 5-point system. And it's not helping. We have an excellent school with fantastic teachers and amazing students, and yet this is a huge stress on us. So I urge you to not only support House Bill 2714 and 13 and 15, but also to strengthen them by taking away penalties for schools where parents do opt out.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you. Next. And we have your written testimony, so you can just summarize briefly.
I'll try my best.
We do have another bill, and
I can testify on the other bill, too, if that would
pardon?
Be better. I can go and sit down and testify on the other bill, 2655, because I think they're pretty similar.
Yeah, whichever. Just
I'll be fast.
We want to be courteous to all people that are here.
I appreciate
here, so.
That, Madam Chairwoman.
But we do have your written testimony. So.
Well, look, as I said in my testimony, I...
if you could identify yourself.
Oh, yeah. My name is Bill Porter. I'm a Portland public school parent. I actually live in Northeast Portland, almost but not quite inside Representative Frederick's district. I do a lot of work around the country with state governments and school districts and nonprofits working in education, but I'm coming to this conversation really as a parent of 2 kids in Portland Public Schools and my own experiences in those schools, and I guess I want to say 3 things. One is that I really think smarter balance is going to be an improvement. I think we've heard a lot of concerns about Oaks. We don't have Oaks anymore, and I think it's really important for me as a parent to have this sort of objective report of how my child at my child's school is doing every year. But I also want to emphasize that I'm not going to come up here and say that Smarter Balanced is perfect. And I've kind of outlined some things here. I think it is going to be bumpy this spring. I do think we need an accountability system that looks at other things besides tests. But I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. Secondly, I want to say I am not going to be opting my children out of the Smarter Balanced exam this spring. I'm actually excited about it. I've taken the time to look at the test questions. I've actually read the standards on which the test is based. And I would encourage all of you to take the time to do that if you haven't already. I will also say that teachers in my school are not up in arms. The standards really emphasize problem solving, reasoning, inquiry, and writing. And that's what we all have been talking about today about what we want kids to be focused on. So I think it's a good thing. I also wanted to say that I think it's bad public policy to encourage parents to be refuseniks and not have their children take state tests. Tests aren't fun. I know they can be stressful. Coming to testify is stressful. That doesn't mean I stay home and don't do it. That doesn't mean it's not unimportant. I want to know if my children are hitting an objective standard for success, and I want to know how well my child's school is doing overall, and that requires everyone to participate. I sympathize with the concerns about too much testing, but let's unpack those. The research that you cite, Madam Chairwoman, about too much testing in schools, if you actually look at that, most of that comes from local tests. It's not the state test. It's what the school decides to put on in the local school district. So I would say let's amend your bill, Representative Frederick, and let's let parents opt out of local tests and not the state test. I just think it's too soon to sort of declare Smarter Balanced a failure and start legislating a whole lot of fixes. If the problem is Oaks, well, that's not a problem anymore because we don't have Oaks, and I've heard a lot of discussion about Oaks today. If test prep is a problem, let's let parents opt out of test prepping, although I think the sort of preparation that kids are going to do well in Smarter Balanced is exactly the sort of great teaching we're going to hear that we've heard about today. It's the reasoning, it's the thinking, it's the looking at original sources, it's the writing. That's what Smarter Balance measures. If the problem is that change seems to be going too fast, Madam Chairwoman, your bill might make a whole lot of sense. Let's slow things down a little bit. If accountability system is the problem, if we want additional measures besides tests, let's get to work on something like the chief education officer has proposed. I just really feel like if we want kids to be developing problem-solving skills, analysis, and writing, then we need a test that asks kids to problem-solve, analyze, and write. And that's what Smarter Balance offers. Change is hard, and the change to new standards and a different test isn't easy. I don't think anybody came here to say that it would be easy. I encourage all of you to focus constructively on how best to create an accountability system that provides the right information and not throw out the baby or all the state testing with the bathwater. Just one final note. I did include some stuff that I found last night online about Smarter Balance testing. That's not something that I personally own. It's just stuff I found online. I thought it would be helpful. I know the deputy superintendent provided some other information. But it's got some nice examples of some of the test questions and some justification about why they appear in the test.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Doug Bridge. I'm a third grade teacher in North Clackamas School District. I am that slide that Deputy Superintendent Saxon put up on the board. I teach at 100% free and reduced school. And I just want to tell you quickly about my class. I have 22 third graders right now. That's the lowest class I've had in 15 years by far. There are nine of my students get food on Friday or put in their backpacks to help them tide their families over for food and security reasons until Monday morning when they can come back to my school and get free breakfast and get a free lunch. So I am living this third grade benchmark high poverty school. And this testing is absolutely the biggest waste of time that I could use. As I'm sitting here right now, my substitute teacher is launching into a three-week unit. She's doing the first day of this unit that is solely based on getting my students ready, my 8 and 9-year-olds ready to take a test. 3 weeks is almost 10% of my instruction time for reading out of the year to get ready for a test. Of course we have to test people, but when we talk about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, we've already done that. We've thrown it out. We're giving them a test that we expect two-thirds of them to fail. Where else in our society do we do that? Lawyers, doctors, driving permits? I have no idea. It's a completely unrealistic expectation. So I just wanted to come and put a face to that, and I want to encourage you to support House Bill 2713 so we can take an honest look at how much of our time and resources are going into this massive, massive high-stakes test.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of this panel? Thank you very much for coming down to testify. Okay, that's all we have signed up. So with that, I close the public hearing on House Bills 2714, 2713, and 2715. And I open up a public hearing on House Bill 2655. If you could want to come on up, Richard will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2655 directs the State Board of Education to adopt specified standards related to the student education records. It provides that parents have the right to excuse students from statewide standardized summative assessments and that school districts must provide notice of that right to parents. It provides that students must receive certain information related to statewide standardized summative assessments and declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015.
Representative Gorsuch, welcome. We have a little theme going here.
Yeah, I noticed that. Well, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Chris Gorsuch. I'm the state representative for District 49, East Multnomah County, and I am here to speak in support of House Bill 2655. So we are talking a lot, as we've seen in this room today, about issues related to high-stakes testing. There are a lot of concerns that I hear from both parents and teachers in my district, and these concerns can range from anything related to the actual validity of the data, the actual social science best practices that are involved, the time that it takes, as we just heard from somebody else. One parent who also teaches at a middle school in my district, this was something that she sent to us recently. She's opted out of both of her children, out of taking the Smarter Balance test this year for the following reasons. It's developmentally inappropriate, in her opinion. It doesn't measure what is being taught in the classroom. It doesn't inform her instruction. It takes away hours of instructional time, as well as taking away technological resources to be used for other projects. There's also been some discussion about the how the Smarter Balance would reduce the amount of time used for testing, but she she hasn't found this to be the case. Another one of my constituents who's a teacher, Tricia Snyder, said that just after winter break, she'd been planning to teach a narrative paper, a genre study of historical fiction, reassess each student's reading level, and teach the Stone Age in sixth grade social studies. That was supposed to happen in January. 2 days back from break, she was told in an email from the school testing coordinator that they needed to take 4 days to do the interim testing for Smarter Balance, and that it would start next week. So she indicates that they had to get trained to administer the test on early release day instead of doing other professional development activities, and were basically expected to put all their other teaching aside. And this was a district directive, as they had purchased the test and needed to use it. So there's a little bit more here, but I'll just jump forward and talk about 2655, since we're running out of time here. Basically, what it would do is create a Bill of Rights for students and parents who are looking for relief from the damage that they feel is caused due to the overuse and misuse of high-stakes testing. So that Bill of Rights would allow students and parents to know that they have a right to excuse their students from high-stakes testing for any reason. The details of every statewide assessment a student would be expected to take in the coming year, when they would be expected to take the test, how much it would was costing the school district, the purpose of the test, how the results were interpreted, and when the results would be available to students. So to conclude this very quickly, this is a way to give people some clarity around what they really can do in terms of whether they want their students to be involved in this testing or not. And that's basically what the bill would do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Any questions of Representative Gorsuch? Okay, thank you. Well, we do, as I said, we have another committee coming in here at 3, so that's why we're a little, we don't have much leeway. But some of the people that have signed up spoke on the other bills. Two people that did not were Karen Stratton and Celeste Pelici. If they'd like to come forward, and then we'll see if we have time. We have another 6 signed up, but they'd have to be done by quarter till. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I am Karen Stratton, and I heard Representative Wilson quoting from my testimony that I had submitted last night, and I appreciate that you had a chance to read it and thought about it carefully. So I wanted to tell you that the quotes I included in my written testimony were actually from some of my best students, and a concern that I have this year for my fifth graders is my not best students. And so I thought maybe I would read to you a very short little statement. This was what one student wrote. She's from Afghanistan. She'd been in the country for about 5 years and been in public school that whole time, but hadn't really started to read until fifth grade when I had her last year. And I just want you to think about how she might do on an opinion essay, having to write it on the computer after reading 3 long passages when she's barely reading in fifth grade. This is what she wrote. Dear Mrs. Seeby, that was our principal. We did a lot of testing all these days, but just 3 tests. I'll tell you the first one we did. First we did reading. Next it was math. And last we did science. I really wanted to finish it, but I didn't. It's just that I go so slow, so my tests I never finish. The first test I did, I got 218, which I think is good, but I still did not get my source 1-2 more. Don't know what that means. Testing is not so fun, but for some people it is, but I want to know why. Are they good at it? Do they know who to do it better? I don't think I'll ever get a good grad in my tests, but not when I try, but I still get 1/3 of it wrong. Some days in testing days, I'm really happy to test, but some days I'm not. Some days I wish I get 10 out of 10 so I can get good at my testing. Testing is boring because in my tests I have so many testing pages from 1 all the way to 50. And the class is lucky because they have to do from 1 to 20. That's why I never finish my tests. Mm-hmm. The part about testing I like is the reading test. Because of the nice stuff you read, then awesomer, then I love reading. Hope the stuff I told the parts of testing I love and hate. So it gives you a sense of where some fifth graders are in their ability to communicate in English. And to think of this kind of child having to read 3 long passages and make sophisticated comparisons about what maybe the authors thought and the motivations of the characters were, it boggles my mind as to what that would feel like for that child. I personally sat down yesterday as I was writing my testimony to look again at the English language performance assessment. I read through the first passage. It was all about using capuchin monkeys as service animals. That was kind of interesting. But then I couldn't figure out exactly what I was supposed to do. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, I'm going to have to teach my students how to read this and then figure out where do I take my notes and where do I write my opinion. And it's scrolling back and forth. And I've got several graduate degrees. And we're expecting fifth graders to do this. We're expecting third graders to do this, eight-year-old children. So anyway, you've heard a lot of the same arguments today. I personally would prefer Smarter Balanced went away and we supplanted it with something that's more useful for teachers, parents, and kids. But in the meantime, if you would just let parents opt out. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Celeste?
My name is Celeste Pellicci. I am an eighth grade science teacher in the Gladstone School District. I'm also a parent of a seventh grade child at Hosford Middle School in Portland Public. We are opting our child out. My wife and I are opting our child out this year and all other years in the future if we're able to. We know that Tucker's abilities are not going to be measured by this test. High stakes tests don't measure the critical components of his future achievement. Research indicates that Tucker's mindset, perseverance, ability to work collaboratively, and creative thinking are his most reliable indicators of success. I don't want him to spend time on a test that doesn't measure those things and doesn't encourage those things. Portland Public recently changed their opt-out form, and the top of it now reads in a different way to fortify their ability to deny parents opt-out requests. I'm worried about that. Parents have the right to opt their children out of classes, lessons, or units based on their personal opposition. So why are we making Smarter Balance the exception to these standard practices? Doesn't seem right. You have my written testimony, I believe. And so thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions to these panelists? Okay, thank you. We have written testimony from the other four people that signed up, and so, and you can tell, Representative Wilson, we actually do read these, and we had about 48 pieces that people submitted, so we've all read them, and we appreciate not only the time you took, but also coming down and testifying with us. So with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2655, and I think that is it for the day. I adjourn the House Committee on the House Committee on Education. Thank you all very much.
Does it make any sense? Sounds good. Thank you
all very much.
Does it make any sense? Sounds good. Thank you.
House Committee on Education.